cultural relativity and individual relativity. You know, like there's different subcategories, right, of subjectivity, of relativism. Are you a psychological or a philosophical egoist who believes that whatever is good for an individual person is moral for that person to do? Like, that's right. Whatever is good for a person, the person ought to do. That's psychological or philosophical egoism, I should say. Or are you a cultural relativist who suggests that if a culture agrees upon certain normative values, and those are by definition morally right, but although that also sounds like constructionism, but what I'm trying to say is, if an individual takes the position that there is no objective moral directive, that there is no an anti-realism view, right, an anti-realism morality is simply constructed by individuals or by cultures, then what business does someone have to say? Does that person have to say? What business of that person is it to judge other people or other cultures? Because implicitly, if I were to say killing is wrong and tell someone else you shouldn't kill, then implicitly I'm making a claim that there is something objective. There's an objective rule which forbids killing. So I guess what I'm saying here is that I'm saying that the position of subjectivity, to deny that there are objective moral standards, I believe commit oneself to a pretty radical position, which is that person shouldn't, and we shouldn't comment or judge or pass judgment upon or try and influence or change what other people do. And that leads us down a very scary rabbit hole where there is no justification for trying to stop Adolf Hitler. There's no justification for trying to protect vulnerable people from harm. There's no justification to protect women, where they're subjected to abuse. So I guess I'm returning back to the general argument of relativism or subjectivism versus objectivity, which is, how can one possibly be a subjectivist and deny the existence of objective moral standards that are out there that are independent of and superior to my personal viewpoints? How can one possibly do that without abandoning all efforts to make the world a better place?
We all have individual beliefs about what we believe is right or wrong. And we don't always know where those things come from, but we know that they are right and good. And one of the ways we know this is because people believe similar things. And it's true, no matter, what culture you go around the world for almost any time period, no one really believes that you should kill someone or harm someone just for the sake of it. That's just seen as unnecessary cruelty. So then, is there such a thing as necessary cruelty in a society? And different societies have answered that question differently. But I think, to answer Michael's point, I think subjectivism would see the answer as being less that, it's not the case that killing is wrong. It would be more that it is the case that killing is wrong for more than one reason, or that there might be multiple justifications there for why a certain claim is wrong in different situations, rather than being a universal claim that all killing is wrong because killing is wrong because it is a detriment to the human race. I mean, we can make a universal argument like that, and I think the most famous one that I'm familiar with is from Marcus Aurelius, where he basically states in universal terminology that the nature of human beings is to essentially live in harmony with other human beings. That is what he describes as essentially the basis for his morality in the Meditations. So we have a different perspective as modern people than he did. Some modern people might have the same perspective. But the point is that I don't think subjectivism necessarily states that you don't believe in moral claims Rather, it means that you may recognize there are other claims that are also correct. What do you think about that, Mihai? Do I have a misunderstanding there?
No. I think you're touching on something which I'll hopefully clarify here by giving you some terminology. So there is such thing as moral... There's also such a thing as moral nihilism, which is, I think, what you're touching on here. So moral nihilism is the idea that there are no objective, claims, no objective ethical claims, and we should throw the whole thing down the drain, and ethics doesn't matter. However, that's not what subjectivism states. So I'll answer both you and Mikey at the same time here by saying that basically what subjectivism disagrees with, what it denies, is that there is such thing as timeless, objective, universal ethical claims. But as you say, Aaron, that doesn't mean that there necessarily is no such thing as morality. If you're a moral nihilist, you'll say that. But a moral subjectivist has a way of describing morality, even if there are no objective laws that exist outside of us to govern our morality. So let me explain. Often, subjectivists, you start at something like simple subjectivism, which basically says, it seems to make people infallible. And I think that's what Mikey was getting at, is that unless you're wrong about your own feelings somehow, you can't actually be wrong, because all morality is your personal subjective feelings on the matter. But that seems to be insufficient, because again, it maybe gets this idea that like moral debate and moral discussion means nothing anymore, which obviously is a bit worrisome. Then you move from that to something called emotivism, which basically tells us that speech serves a couple of different functions. The first is to relay information, right? Facts. But the second is to influence human action, right? So it serves a purpose. Our language, when you try to motivate someone to do something, you're not necessarily relaying information so much as just trying to convince them or influence them to do something. And they're independent. The thing about this is it's kind of a Machiavellian take where you're saying that whatever tool that works best works, and you know, the ends justify the means. So if you just want, you know, to describe it emotionally, say whatever you want to influence people to follow your subjective opinion on what morality should be, right? And then what I described earlier, you go a little bit further, and there are some people that claim that rather than just it being subjective and influencing people's emotions, there is a step that you can take where basically educated, calm, rational people would be able to think a situation through and somehow kind of converge at the end on the right emotions for that situation. And so you get a kind of convergence where a lot of people would have a similar response to something, but it's still just based on subjective emotion, if that makes sense, right? So you clear away kind of the rubble, you clear away anything that, you know, you think through the rational steps of a situation, and then at the end you're kind of left with your emotions, and that tells you how to act. But if a lot of people can come to the same emotions, you get a similar answer between individuals, right? While still remaining subjective. Now, I have problems with all of these claims, but that is to say, just because you're making a subjectivist claim, this to answer you, Mikey, doesn't mean you have to throw all morality away and be unable to judge people or to judge certain actions. Because again, you're just judging it based on your own emotions. So the judgment's still happening. It just, there is no objective answer. And yes, that is troubling. That's why I disagree with this subjectivist claim in the first place, because it's kind of troubling to say, there's no right answer to is killing for fun wrong. Like Aaron said, it seems a lot of people think that killing for fun is wrong. But if you say there's no objective answer to it, then I have no right to judge someone that goes out and kills people for fun, which is really troubling. To answer Aaron, you can be a subjectivist and not necessarily ignore all of morality and say it's all garbage. That would be nihilism. But to answer Mikey, I think there is something deeply troubling about that.
I want to talk also a little bit about the is-ought distinction, which is what we learn. It's one of the basic premises of certainly of normative ethics anyway. And that's also describable as a distinction between descriptive and prescriptive. So Yeah. So there's different ways to put it, but I think it's an important concept. I just wanted to touch on that because sometimes it seems like we drift back and forth between the empirical and the prescriptive. So there's one way to study morality, and that's empirically, which is a descriptive study. It's what do people do? Let's look at the way people and cultures around the world approach morality. What are the various moral systems that are adopted? How many people behave ethically? How many don't according to their own standards? That's an empirical study. And that is quite distinct from the study of normative ethics, because normative ethics, if you go take an ethics course at an institution, that's not what you study. You do not study what people do, not in an ethics course, not in a philosophy course. You study what people ought to be doing. You study what types of systems, what type of evidence do we have? What kind of reasoning can be used? Who are the various theorists that have written about what people ought to do? And how can they either discover or determine through rational analysis or through logic, depending on what your normative ethical theory is, how can people figure out how they should behave? That's very distinct from a study of how people, in fact, do behave. And if your meta-ethical belief, I'm approaching what I said before sort of from a different angle, if your meta-ethical belief on a meta scale is that there are no standards which govern how people ought to behave, people choose for themselves, then you really have no reason to take a normative ethics course or to involve yourself or research or theorize about normative ethics, because you've already disqualified yourself. You've said there's no way that people ought to behave. People choose for themselves. Now, if your meta-ethical theory is sort of some sort of cultural relativism, then you might make the claim that, well, within a particular culture, people ought to behave a certain way because that's from where ethics derive, is from the culture. You can take that position, on a meta scale, but then, we can object to that in various ways. For example, like what constitutes a culture? How do you define culture? Can't two people start a club and say, now we're a culture, and therefore we get to create our own, ethical theories? So I just wanted to distinguish between that, because we kind of drift in the show, and it's very common to drift back and forth between what the world looks like versus how people ought to behave or what the world ought to look like. And I just wanted to clarify that normative ethics, and you did mention this earlier, Mihai, I want to credit you for that. Normative ethics is the study of how people ought to behave. If you want to know how people do behave, which is obviously quite distant from how people ought to behave in so many cases, right? Then that's more like sociology or anthropology or some science like that. But ethics, as it emerges and appears and is studied in philosophy, is really about how people ought to behave and how do we know how we ought to behave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. That is a really good point. And that's something that people bring up in favor of something like subjectivism, that you can't really describe the world. You can't move from is to ought. You can't describe the world with something that you simply is a desire, is a value. However, if you would be able to create or to describe some kind of system by which, so morality kind of has two parts, right? It's how we should act and what are the obligations for us to act that way. So if you have a story for what the obligation is for us to act that way, that serves the purpose of, moving from ought to is, because you describe what ought to be, how we should act, and then you describe that there is an obligation to act that way, which in a sense doesn't move us from ought to is, in that it doesn't describe a fact, but if you can describe, so that's the job of normative ethics, right? It tells what is the obligation, and then you kind of get over that hurdle. With metaethics, it's a little more difficult, and I'll credit you because that is that's something that people argue often. But I do want to leave some room for our other co-hosts to jump in here.
Well, I think you need to have a very particular sense of world to make this work. I think you need to see the world as an overarching structure in order to make any of this work. But the reality of society is, in a sense, it's a group of people meeting, interacting, and exchanging within a very specific world perspective. And this is where my existential training is going to come in full force. That although we live in a society which we often see to be a more complete, holistic, world of which we all inhabit, the entirety of our relations happen in direct response to our individual worlds. But I would still make the claim for objective morality in this sense, that we gather our morality from stories and experiences which are foundational to the development of that society, so that we have, say, something like creation stories in certain communities that informs the origin of where that society came from. We look to historical stories to show us how we should or should not act. The mutual agreed upon standard in that sense makes the judgment or makes the expectation objective, because everyone is assenting to it or is expected to assent to it. Those who do not have prior experience within that societal framework. And I think one final point, and then I'll let Mihai respond, is quite simply that, and it's to Michael's point, you can absolutely create a culture and determine a culture within clubs and small factions, but that is more a sociological exploration of subcultures being present or opposed to what we would deem to be the dominant culture.
So I want to make one last pitch here for the relativist view and see what you think of this. I'll bring you a concrete example because I think this will help. So clearly we have disagreements on pure subjectivity. We have disagreements on objectivity, which, by the way, for me is how do you find these objective truths? And I think just agreeing on them is indication of relativism, not realism, taken to your point, because you will not find an entire world of people agreeing to any given ethical statement, I think. And regardless, it would be impossible to conduct that kind of test. But I don't think that there's any one claim that every single person on the planet has agreed to at some point or another. But let me bring you this in-between story. So here I'm going to quote a writer by the name of David Wong, writes on relativism in this particular book. And he says this. So he's talking about the argument that basically relativism, there are a number of goods, basically, that can describe our ethical action. So just to quickly reiterate, a good is like what we are aiming for. And the right, the theory of the right, is how we should respond to that good. So, for example, if we value dignity, how should we respond to it by valuing it, by you know, in each situation, giving dignity a priority in our actions. So let me give you an example here. One apparent and striking ethical difference that would be a good candidate for this sort of argument concerns the emphasis on individual rights that is embodied in the ethical culture of the modern West, and that seems absent in traditional cultures found in Africa, China, Japan, and India. The content of duties in such traditional culture instead seems organized around the central value of a common good that consists in a sort of ideal community life, a network of relationships, partially defined by social roles, again, ideal, but imperfectly embodied in ongoing existing practice. So we're talking about, do we value the individual or the community more, right? This is a difference that seems to be quite prominent between cultures. What Wong says about this, and I'll quote again, morality centered on such values would seem to differ significantly from one centered on individual rights to liberty and to other goods. And he's talking about Confucianism here, that it would be quite different. And he says, if the contrast between the two types of morality is real, it raises the question of whether one or the other type is truer or more justified than the other. The argument for a relativistic answer may start with the claim that each type focuses on a good that may reasonably occupy the center of an ethical life for a human life. On the one hand, there's the good of belonging to and contributing to a community. On the other, there's the good of respect for the individual, apart from any potential contribution to community. It would be surprising, the argument goes, if there were to just one justifiable way of setting a priority with respect to the two goods. It should not be surprising, after all, if the range of human goods is simply too rich and diverse to be reconciled in just a single moral ideal. End quote. So what this indicates to me is something like this. Reasonably speaking, you could say that a human being leads an ethical life if they are more individualistic or if they're more community-oriented. But just because we have a diverse and rich variety of things that we might value and around which we might center our ethics, like if we value individualism, you might say you value dignity, you value, you know, personal ambition and achievement and success, etc. So you could reasonably say that a person living in the West who is more individualistic and a person living in one of these other cultures who is more community-oriented are both ethical people. And so the difference is not that one is true and one is false, or that those people simply decide for themselves, I think I want to be more this way and I'm an ethical person. No, there is an objective kind of framework that they live under, one more individualistic and one more community-based, but both can coexist because it's relative to culture in this case. So if you're living in the Western culture and you would be wrong to do certain things that violate other people's individual liberty based on law, but also based on social mores, etc. Whereas if you live in another culture where that is not so important, you may not be wrong for doing that. And that doesn't mean that one person is living their life wrong and the other is not. So that's a really good example in my pitch for thinking of it as a middle ground, not necessarily fully subjective and not fully objective.
How you show respect in different cultures is very different. Like, you know, some cultures bow. In Western culture, making eye contact is shown for being, this makes you an honest person. In some Asian cultures, making eye contact is a direct insult. So there, I think this is kind of, I don't know if everything is quite that trivial for relativism, but those are some easy examples, if nothing else.
We have to be careful of false dilemmas and of generalization. So I wouldn't accept the claim that individual rights are antithetical to community. There may be examples of very community-oriented people that are very abusive toward individuals and don't protect the rights of individuals. Like, for example, think about like a white colonial community in New England, you know, back in the colonial days when the Europeans came to North America, who were extremely abusive toward indigenous people. They thought of indigenous people as no better than animals, and they really only believed in human rights for, you know, white male landowners. The founders of the United States and the authors of the Constitution only included white male landowners in the body of people that were to be, you know, given the vote and be given quote-unquote democratic rights. And yet, I believe they had a very strong sense of community. In fact, it was their sense of community that led them to protect their white heritage from pollution by indigenous people or non-white people. On the other hand, you can have democratic values where you believe in a balance between individual rights, protection of individual rights, but also strong community values. I would be careful about, you know, making, you know, putting community on one pole and individual rights on another pole, because one could conceive of a society, and I think this is one of the directions that liberal democratic countries have been trying to go, where both are valued, where both community, respect for the community, the good of the community, and individual rights within that community are protected.
But it would just serve to show you that people that live predominantly according to one system and predominantly according to the other seem to coexist as ethical individuals, which I think is the point I'm trying to make here, that these differences are indicative of the nature of moral judgments not being objective and universal, nor just individualistic, but established and followed relative to context. And to answer to your point about, for example, people who, like you're talking about America and Britain and privileging certain individuals when it comes to rights in that particular society, much of that, to bring it back to an earlier point I made, can be attributed to erroneous factual claims, in a sense. So, for example, believing that scientifically or somehow objectively some people are above or beneath others, or so on, it doesn't describe the whole system, but I want to say that it's another way of showing that there can be beliefs that are founded on wrong factual bases, and that's what makes them wrong as beliefs. Now I see that we are out of time, so as much as this conversation has been riveting and I'd love to continue it, I have to say goodbye to my hosts for now. And if you do have more questions, who knows, maybe we'll do a part 3. Maybe the audience has some material to add as well. I just want to thank the audience for listening. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. Once again, you can find archives of the show now on tcps.podbean.com.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/the Canadian Philosophy Show and tcps.podbean.com.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.